Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Daily Briefing. This is Amanda Borchel-Dunn, and today is Monday, January 10th. I'm joined by our diplomatic reporter, Laser Berman, and news editor, Amy Spiro. Hello to both of you.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Today, we have a lot to talk about, as always, including whether the Western Wall Compromise is closer to being implemented, a little-known pro-Israel organization with great reach, an update on the race to head the Jewish Agency, and an Orthodox ice skater heading to the Winter Olympics. Stick around after the show, because at the end of the episode, I've included a brief excerpt from a podcast I recorded with our now president, Isaac Herzog, who was then the head of the Jewish Agency, in which he speaks about his mother, Ara Herzog, who died last night at age 97. Amy, let's begin with you and a piece you wrote on the Western Wall Compromise that was recently published on the Times of Israel. Now, just to remind our listeners, this is a compromise that was widely heralded in January 2016 after 4 years of negotiations, and it was frozen on June 25th, 2017. What has happened recently for it to be in the news again?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. So first of all, it's just the fact that we have a new government after Netanyahu was in power for so long, and Netanyahu was the one who originally signed this deal and then froze it. So now you have a new coalition in town, and it's a coalition that has promised to change a lot of things, particularly on religion and state, and they've made big strides in terms of kosher certification reform, and they're talking a lot about conversion reform. And so, there's certainly a question if this would be next. And in fact, a lot of the coalition deals that were signed when the government was formed addressed the Western Wall Compromise deal, and many of them included a promise to bring that up to the table. But in the past couple of months, we've seen the government sort of step away from that promise and walk back, at least certain elements of the government walk back those promises. And at the same time as that, there's a Supreme Court case on the issue that's been going on for years. It predates this government. And last month, the state submitted its official response. The bottom line was they asked for another 6 months, and they said, to look into the issue, to deal with the issue, and they officially appointed the cabinet secretary, Shalom Shlomo, to renew the dialogue, and he has had meetings with some of the relevant parties. So, but the other time, the state did not commit to bringing it back in any way. It basically said, we're going to maintain what's going on, we're going to look into it, and we'll get back to you in 6 months.
Now, we should remind our listeners that in 2013, it was our now Prime Minister Naftali Bennett who did build the platform that is in place right now in the Robinson's Arch area. It's kind of a rickety-ish kind of platform. I would compare it to bleachers that you would sit on for a parade. But Amy, you were out there recently. Do you feel like there's any chance that under this Prime Minister, anything will actually be implemented?
Yeah, there's often a lot of irony in Israeli politics, and there's no small amount of irony that Bennett was the one who basically overnight sort of erected this platform in 2013. Now, he has been very careful, not just since become prime minister, but also while running, to not really take a very strong stance on the issue. He's certainly not one of the people who's come out and said, we're going to do this. This is on our agenda. So it's hard for me to imagine that the big strides are on the way. The issues of kashrut and conversion are also very, big touchstones and lightning rods in the Haredi community. And there are some elements that think that this issue is even a bigger concern, that, we've seen the response on kashrut and on conversion, and we've seen the anger and the threats. And there's some analysts who think the response, to bringing this compromise deal back would be even stronger. Now, whether or not it's as big as those is a question mark, right? The plaza exists. It's in existence. It needs renovation. It needs expansion. Also, as I noted in the article, that the portion of the platform that actually abuts the Western Wall, we were able to touch the stones, has been closed for years since actually a big rock fell out of the wall in 2018, crash landed onto it. And so that's something that has not been fixed. That area is not able to access. And actually, nothing moves particularly quickly in this country. And anything that happens right at the wall goes through so many layers of archaeologists and approval and everything like that. So it's not hugely shocking, but, you know, it's been almost 4 years since that rock fell out. So, you know, I spoke to the executive director of Women in the Wall, who sat in the meeting with Cabinet Secretary Shalom Shlomo last month. And she said, you know, the government is promising to do things. The government is promising to fix things and to move certain things along, not all elements of the compromise deal. But they're not given any timeline. They're not saying when this is going to happen. They're not saying, you know, how it's going to happen. They're saying we're working on it. So there's sort of like cautious hope that people hope things are going to move forward, but they don't really feel like things are actively happening at the moment.
Lisa, moving over to you, you wrote about this organization that I am so ashamed to admit I'd never heard of them, though I've been working in the space of Jewish world for over a decade. It's the United States Israel Education Association. What is this group exactly?
Sure. First of all, don't be ashamed, because the reason I dug down into this organization, because I hadn't heard of them either until I met with the CEO, Heather Johnston, less than a year ago in Jerusalem. And I figured if there's such an organization that people have not heard of, that but is having such a profound effect on the U.S.-Israel relationship, then I think it's imperative that our readers are aware of it and know what they're up to. Usually, everyone's heard of AIPAC and Q5, Christians United for Israel. But here we have this organization based in all places, of all places, in Birmingham, Alabama, that has less than 10 people on staff. That came about 10 years ago, kind of, you know, by chance. Heather was in Ariel. She knew the mayor then, Ron Nachman, and she started in the 90s, actually. She was helping him absorb the influx of Russian-speaking immigrants. And while she was doing that over the years, she realized that congressmen and women were not reaching West Bank settlements. They were really not crossing the green line. Once in a while, AIPAC would bring some of their delegations to Efrat, but they really weren't seeing the reality on the ground in the West Bank. So she worked with Eric Cantor and some other congressional leaders and focused on bringing senior congressional leadership to West Bank communities, places like Hebron, places like Shiloh, so that they can really see the reality there and understand why it's important to Israelis and to Jews that there is a thriving presence there. And they also make the argument that it's better for Palestinians as well. Now, their first big initiative was Iron Dome. They were able to get Benjamin Netanyahu in 2011 to overnight declassify the first operational battery near Ashkelon. And they were able to bring these senior members to see it. And that's what really amazed them. And once they were able to see this battery stationed near Gaza, they understood the importance of funding it. So Barack Obama in 2011 had already authorized $275 million in funding for additional R&D, and they were able to help these members develop a plan and draft legislation for another almost $700 million. So that was certainly meaningful in deploying those additional batteries and furthering research. And they've continued the medium-range system, David Sling, the Arrow 3 system, which is the anti-ballistic system. They were able to bring members to see that for the first time as well, and to push for a joint test between the U.S. and Israeli missile defense agencies in Alaska. So they were really meaningful players in drumming up support for funding of these systems on Capitol Hill. They've also been very active in supporting joint Israeli and Palestinian businesses and business ventures in the West Bank. And that culminated in the Nita Lowy Act, MEPA, which is tens of millions of dollars over 5 years to fund joint projects in the West Bank. And Heather Johnston, the CEO of USIEA, is on the board of that as well. And what's really interesting is their project, their initiative that's in its drafting stages, that members from both parties are working to learn from the lessons of COVID, and they understand that having the U.S. pharma and life sciences supply chain based in China is not something that the U.S. wants. It harms citizens. It harms Israel's, U.S. national security. And they are working to bring the pharma and life sciences industries into the Abraham Accord countries, including Jordan and Egypt, I should add. And that will, in their view, and I agree with this, be a net win for the U.S. and also for those countries as well. One of the things they have to do is get an FDA office in the Middle East, because there isn't one right now. And it's hard for that whole network to work together if there is not such an office. So that is one of the things they're working on. Again, this is in the drafting stage. They're working on legislation, but this is something hopefully I'll be able to follow up on as it moves forward.
Okay, we look forward to that. Now we're going to move to a short break.
Hey, it's Jessica Steinberg. If you have an important message you'd like to share with people who care deeply about Israel and the Jewish world, there's really no better way to do that than by advertising in our podcasts. Reach the Times of Israel's unique community with an audio ad. For more information, email ads@timesofisrael.com. That's ads@timesofisrael.com.
And we're back.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Lazer, talk to us a little bit about the race for the head of the Jewish Agency. Our current Prime Minister, Isaac Herzog, stepped down from the Jewish Agency when he took up the office of a president. What has happened since then? And it seems like things have gone a little bit off the rails, no?
I think that's an understatement. This should be and has historically been a pretty dry and boring race. Over the years, historically, it was basically a rubber stamp. The coalition, the government would put forward its candidate, and then the 10-person nominating committee of the Jewish Agency would move that along, and they would be elected by the 120-person Board of Governors. What happened in recent years is that the nominating committee has shown real independence from the coalition. You had Natan Sharansky in 2017, going back to what Amy was talking about, opposed publicly the plan for Netanyahu to withdraw the plan for the egalitarian prayer space at the Western Wall. And another major sign was the election of Isaac Herzog as the Jewish Agency chairman against the wishes of the coalition. So it's gotten more interesting than you think. Also, the process has not been good for the coalition. Yair Lapid's first candidate, Elazar Stern, had to withdraw in October after revelations that he did not take sexual harassment accusations seriously when he was the head of the IDF Manpower Directorate, that he shredded these complaints. He stepped down, and then it took months for the coalition to come up, or for Lapid to come up with another candidate. In recent weeks, he came up with Ruth Calderon, who was an MK 2013 to 2015, but she is rejected by the orthodox elements of the agency and politics because she's a well-known activist for the reform community. She's a Talmud scholar, but she said in 2014 that she would have bread at her Seder plate. Bennett has not endorsed her. He is expected to never do so. So that adds more intrigue to the race. Gantz has his own candidate, Omer Yankelevich. And I want to point out that both of these candidates, Calderon and Yankelevich, are not giving interviews. The independent candidates are perfectly willing to sit down for a half hour, an hour, and lay out their plans and speak about visions and answer questions, while these coalition-backed candidates are treating it, in my eyes, as more of a political job. So that, I think, is something that people should know.
Okay, so Lazer, you sat down with four of the candidates, in fact, and you got a bit of a sense of their vision from each one. Sometimes when I was reading your piece, it felt like one was giving a dig against the other. I was born in the diaspora, and so I should be the candidate. No, you have to have better English and things like that. Did you get that sense when you were speaking to each of these candidates?
I know that they really do have a lot of respect for each other. The candidates that were born abroad, so that's Michael Loren, Michal Kotler-Wan, she was born in Jerusalem but grew up in Canada, and Fleur Hassan Nahum, I'll stress how important it is for someone to have understood the diaspora experience And that if, you know, you grew up in Israel, you really don't understand that. And that leaves Dani Danon, but he has spent a lot of time in the United States and really is a veteran diplomat, was Israel's UN ambassador. So these are four serious candidates. But again, these are all without any political backing. And all of them say that's an advantage, that they're not beholden to anybody.
Okay. Now, briefly, tell us what Danon says.
Sure. Danon, his focus is on Jewish schools. He says Jewish agencies should get into supporting Jewish schools, that they've gotten way too expensive abroad, especially in the United States. And it's so important for the Jewish future and Jewish continuity that the Jewish agency should play a role there in supporting and funding that.
Okay, Fleur Hasson Nachum.
Fleur Hasson Nachum, I would say her focus is on Jewish communities in unexpected places. So in South America, some of the indigenous communities that are converting or coming out as Jewish, and also in the Gulf. And she says because she grew up in Gibraltar, is of Moroccan heritage, speaks fluent Spanish, Hebrew, English, and some French, would be the first female chairman, that she represents the diversity of the Jewish people that would be appropriate for the position today.
Okay, Michael Oren.
Michael Oren, we all know he's the one with the most star power, you know, an author, a veteran diplomat as well.
Your former professor.
He was my professor, I should say, back in the day at Georgetown. His focus is on the Hebrew language. That like, you know, in the pre-state days, you had these camps in Europe that were in Hebrew language camps. We should have them around the Jewish world. Kids come and use Hebrew language as the lingua franca of the Jewish people. And that will be the future of the connection of the Jewish people to Israel.
Okay. Michal Kadlerwan.
Michal Kadlerwan, she was an international human rights law expert. Her focus is there, fighting anti-Semitism, fighting delegitimization. From a human rights perspective, focusing on the indigeneity of the Jewish people and changing the language that we use to talk about Israel to young people, and really focusing on the threat of BDS and other such movements that are really, she sees it as a long-term threat to the Jewish people's connection to Israel.
Now, Amy, just to finish off, let's speak briefly about Haley Copps, an Orthodox figure skater who is meant to represent Israel along with Evgeny Krasnopolsky in the Winter Olympics. You met with her. What is she like? Who is she?
Yeah, so Haley is a 19-year-old girl who grew up in New Jersey in a modern Orthodox family, went to Orthodox day schools her whole life. And her parents both also, you know, grew up skating. Her mom was a figure skater. Her dad played hockey. And so all of their kids, you know, were encouraged to take to the ice at a young age, and they all did. And she, you know, became very skilled as a figure skater. And she ended up competing for Israel several youth competitions as a teenager. And then she took a break, and she actually came to Israel for a gap year after high school, and studied at a seminary in Jerusalem. And then the head of the Israel Skating Federation just over the summer called up the family and said, you know, would Haley consider teaming up with Evgeny and taking a shot at the Olympics? And she said yes, although her dad said that yes was contingent on not doing any practices on Shabbat. The rest is kind of history. They only skated together for a few months before they managed to qualify. There are only 19 pairs figure skaters who will be competing next month at Beijing at the 2022 Olympics. Israel has never won a Winter Olympics medal. Nobody really expects Israel to win a Winter Olympics medal this year either, but there's a lot of pride in taking part in qualifying and being one of those 19 pairs, and it'll definitely be a story to watch.
We'll be rooting for her, the whole country, definitely. Yofi, thank you both of you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for listening to the Daily Briefing. Now we'll play a brief excerpt from an interview I conducted in 2020 with our president, Isaac Herzog, who was then the head of the Jewish Agency. I asked him about his mother, Ora Herzog, who died Sunday night, aged 97. I would be so appreciative if you could tell me about your mother, who seems to be kind of the overlooked Kennedy, in quotes, of the Herzog family in terms of the popular knowledge about her.
It's a beautiful question. My mother, you know, as the wife of my father, the sixth president of Israel, was the first lady of Israel for 10 years. But my mother is a very special person. She's now 95. She's not in good health. So in fact, you know, it's very difficult to communicate with my mother, but she had an incredible life. My mother was born in Ismailia on the banks of the Suez Canal. Her father was chief engineer of the Suez Canal. Her parents were born in Palestine and they were expelled by the Ottomans, the Turks. In World War I, the Turkish government, because of the war, expelled all those who had a Russian passport. They originated from Russia and they were pioneers and they founded Motza and Khadera and other villages and towns. And my mother was born when they were refugees, actually, in Ismailia, but they were affluent refugees because my grandfather, just like Jacob in the Bible, went down to Egypt, broke bread, and started from scratch. And my mother grew up in Ismailia, then in Cairo, but they always kept touch with their grandparents and their family in Eretz Israel. And then, of course, in 1947, my family was expelled from Egypt. They fled from Egypt. My father met my mother actually in Egypt following World War II. He was a high-ranking officer in the British Army in the most difficult of battles. He was on his way to Palestine, to his parents back. My grandfather was the chief rabbi of Eretz Israel, of Palestine. And on his way back, he looked for a kosher home and asked his best friend, Aubrey Abba Iban, to recommend. And he recommended his wife's family in Cairo. And that's how my parents met. Now, my mother always devoted her life voluntarily to public life. She's the founder of the Bible Quiz, which is a huge event every Independence Day. She was in the army. She was heavily wounded in this building, which we sit in, the Jewish Agency building, back in March 48, and was saved by my father. And this was the first suicide bombing in the country. And then my mother took on major roles in arts, and also as a wife of a diplomat in all my father's careers. But her lifelong passion and love was the foundation of the Council for Beautiful Israel, which was the first main environmentalist organization, pro-environment organization, pro-green in the country. And where she started from nothing in convincing the Israeli public that this is a very important issue. It's called the Council for Beautiful Israel. And she led it for 40 years. So, you know, and then she held many other positions. But my mother, you know, her mother tongue was French. She's a very dignified and beautiful woman. And I learned from her, you know, caring, compassion, and zestfulness to achieve goals. And my parents were a perfect couple, actually, in this realm of doing things for the public good.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing, and thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.